first case on our calendar is 05160 and 161, American Financial Services versus the City of Cleveland. Mr. Kulawitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. The American Financial Services Association and the Ohio Attorney General propose to divide our oral argument into 2 7-minute segments and collectively reserve 1 minute for rebuttal. The state solicitor will speak to the constitutionality of Section 1.63, and I plan to present argument on the appropriate home rule conflict test as to which our courts of appeals have disagreed. The point that I want to make is that the Montgomery County Court of Appeals correctly applied the proper conflict test here, the conflict by implication test that this court has used ever since 1923 in cases involving state laws that use quantitative regulatory lines to distinguish between lawful and unlawful conduct, and that the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals erroneously used a different test. The American Financial Services Association has brought this case in order to help lead the effort to create as unwelcome an environment as possible for predatory lenders in the state of Ohio, while recognizing that we live in a national capital market that depends upon standardization of mortgage laws and forms in order to maximize the flow of capital into our state. The state of Ohio has made a conscientious effort to regulate first and second mortgage loans on a uniform statewide basis. It identifies certain loans as covered loans based on their high interest rates, points, and fees, and provides that covered loans may be made only under certain terms and conditions. We are here today because, apparently for the first time in Ohio history, several cities, including the City of Cleveland, have adopted their own mortgage regulations. In the case of the City of Cleveland, it is as if there is a sign at the city limits that says no loans 3.5 points below the state threshold here, and no covered loans here. The rule of law that should emerge from this case is that these sorts of municipal ordinances conflict with state law because they prohibit conduct that state law allows. Our courts of appeals disagree over this proposition only because they have used different tests from each other. There is a striking difference in those tests, and it is central to this case. The proper test for determining whether the state law and these sorts of municipal ordinances conflict is the conflict by implication test. Beginning in 1923, this court explained in Struthers versus Sokol that a state and local law conflict if the state law, quote, either expressly or inferentially, unquote, permits conduct that a municipal ordinance prohibits. 6 years later, in the Schneiderman versus Sessenstein case, this court ruled that a state law that set a speed limit above which it would be unlawful to drive is equivalent to saying that it is lawful to drive below that speed limit, and that a municipal ordinance that set a lower limit would conflict with state law. 15 years
after. Then in Middleburg Heights, we said that the case law on this is quite difficult to follow, I have to admit. Seems to me there doesn't seem to be a bright line test that fits every case. Would you agree with that?
Well, Your Honor, the bright line test that does fit in this case is the one that the court has applied to state laws that involve quantitative regulatory lines. Whenever there has been a numeric threshold that distinguishes between lawful and unlawful conduct, what this court has said time and time again is that if that threshold has a meaning, it makes a distinction with a difference. That conduct above the threshold, if conduct above the threshold is unlawful, conduct below the threshold, by implication, necessarily is lawful. Mm-hmm. There have been other sorts
In Middleburg Heights, I think we said that the local ordinance building authority or building standards could be different than state building standards. How would you distinguish that case?
Yes, Your Honor, and the reason that the court reached that conclusion in that case is because it was very different from this case. The Ohio Basic Building Code, which was the underlying state law at issue in that case, expressly provided that it was setting forth minimum standards that municipal corporations were free to supplement so long as the supplementary regulations did not conflict with state law.
And this court, in that case, did not apply a conflict situation and analyzed it on different grounds. Isn't that
true? That's correct, Your Honor, because we had a different sort of statute in that case. That was a statute in which the legislature specifically invited municipalities to supplement it as they saw fit. In this case, under House Bill 386, we have exactly the opposite situation. The legislature has set a quantitative regulatory line with the interest rate based on interest rates, points, and fees, and it has expressly said in the uncodified sections of that bill, sections 3 and 4, and in section 1.63 of the Ohio Revised Code, that this is meant to be the only regulation, that we, the General Assembly, have looked at first and second mortgage loans, and it is our informed judgment, our consensus, that these are the only regulations that are to apply.
Well, should we give that? That's the General Assembly saying we've determined that the home rule authority of a city by that statute, 1.63, essentially, as you say, it's just the opposite of Middleburg Heights, which was the General Assembly. This is minimum standard. And 1.63 is just the opposite. It says this is the standard. General Assembly has decided statewide standard, and municipalities, you can't play in this field. But can we really adopt 1.63 as it's written? Because it does attempt to just eliminate any home rule issue, does it not?
Well, Your Honor,
it'd be simple to say, well, 1.63 is the law, and so that's the end of the case.
The significance of Section 1.63 is that it clarifies legislative intent. But by operation of the rest of House Bill 386, Your Honor, any municipal ordinance that attempted to regulate the actual lending transaction almost inevitably would conflict with the state law. Section 1.63 specifies that is the legislative intent.
Well, if the legislative intent is to violate an important provision of the Constitution, does that stop the inquiry?
Well, certainly not. I mean, if this court is the ultimate arbiter over what does and does not violate the Constitution, we certainly acknowledge and recognize that. But importantly, if this court looks back to what you did in the Schneiderman case back in 1929, you had almost exactly the same sort of statutory situation in front of you. There, the state law, which provided driving speed limits that would be above which it would be unlawful to drive, also contained a section in which the General Assembly said, and this is what we mean, these are not to be modified by any municipal corporation in the state. No local law shall be in derogation of these. And this court expressly relied on that, and it looked to that to determine legislative intent. If there were any doubt as to what the General Assembly intended, that section in the Schneiderman case, which has been the precedent in this state for years, decades now, clarify that, and the court explicitly looked to that, and can do the same. The court can do the same thing in this case with 386, if there were any doubt.
So would we follow a traffic analogy? Because certainly part of what would be involved there is the free flow of traffic and commerce across this state and through municipalities, and subject to uniform regulation and. Avoiding surprise, so-called speed traps kinds of things. That had to all be lurking around in the thought process when that analysis was done. So would your company be just like the unsuspecting motorist making loans from one community to another and trapped by the mortgage police sitting behind the billboard ready to get up and collar you if you violate the local ordinance? Is it the same kind of commercial protection that you need, that the motorist would need?
Well, Your Honor, as a practical matter, where the concern really has consequences is in the secondary market, on which we depend to maximize the flow of capital into our economy. Secondary market financers are almost inevitably going to lose confidence in buying loans, absorbing loans from the state of Ohio, if they cannot tell with certainty that a loan that is enforceable at one point under the state law in one part of the state is going to be enforceable elsewhere in the state. If they have to go to a city-by-city analysis of what is and is not an enforceable loan, it can only shake, erode, and perhaps destroy.
Well, surely in the secondary market they would be sophisticated enough to require a contractual assurance that that the seller has complied with both state and local legal requirements, would they not?
Your Honor, one would hope, but what we have, the experience that we have seen so far in Cleveland is that lenders tend to leave the market in order to avoid exactly that sort of risk. They want to maximize their ability to sell the loans into the secondary market. Lest I take away time from the Solicitor General, let me close by asking that this court reverse the judgment of the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals and adopt the rulings of the Montgomery County Court of Appeals on the certified conflict question.
Thank you, Mr. Kulwitz. Mr. Cole.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, I'm not here today to defend in any way predatory lending. The only question before the court is whether the General Assembly can take steps to ensure the efficacy of statewide mortgage regulation by, in appropriate circumstances, denying municipalities the ability to adopt regulations that would in some way interfere with the goal the General Assembly is attempting to achieve. So in that vein, I want to focus on three points this morning. First, in deciding whether a law such as RC 1.63 is a general law, you can't look at that statutory section in isolation. The question is whether, as part of the bigger whole, as part of the regulatory whole, does it meet the definition for general law? Second, the court below adopted a proposed rule for conflict that is incorrect based on this court's jurisprudence. It suggested that it can never conflict when it's merely an ordinance is merely more restrictive than a state statute, and that simply is not what this court has said. Finally,
isn't that the same argument that was made in the gun case that was recently argued, that the statute set the length for certain types of weapons and the cities were free to set shorter lengths? Are we talking about the same principle here?
Well, I think in a sense, Your Honor, the court below adopted the rule that says whenever, without looking at legislative intent, without looking at anything, whenever what we have is a prohibition by the state, that a more restrictive prohibition, and of course there's a question in any given case what more restrictive means, but that a more restrictive prohibition is per se all right, that it can't be in conflict.
So the statute would have to specifically say this is the standard and you can't even do anything more restrictive. If it's silent, their position is that allows it.
That's certainly the position that the other side is advocating here, Your Honor. And I would suggest that the correct inquiry is, let's look to the legislative intent of the General Assembly. Did they intend for what they specified to be a minimum, or did they intend to allow for supplementation regulation below that threshold?
If you read 163, it says the state is solely going to do this. We're preempting the field. Nobody's going to do it, only the General Assembly. Isn't that what it says?
That's what 1.63 says, Your Honor, as part of a broader regulatory enactment directed at this area generally.
So maybe you don't even get into questions about degrees if there's a sole preemption.
Well, Your Honor, I hesitate to call it a sole preemption. I think that's what
the statute says.
That's what the statute uses the word preemption in its title, Your Honor. But 386, House Bill 386, which 1.63 was part of, is a broad set of regulations directed to the mortgage lending industry. 1.63 is part of that and designed to ensure its success by preventing localities from in a sense, playing with the rules or changing the rules in some way. And so that leads to the final point, which I want to cover, which is with respect to issues of statewide concern, and this court has recognized in a number of its cases this doctrine of statewide concern. With respect to issues of statewide concern, the General Assembly has the power to tell municipalities, with respect to this subject matter area, I'm sorry, we can't allow you to regulate here because it will interfere with the uniform statewide solution. We can go back to look at cases, Cleveland Electric Illuminating, State XRL McElroy, decertification of Eastlake, Kettering, all of those are cases in which the court acknowledged that principle.
They seem to have two issues here then, if I'm correct. One is the state has this regulation and can cities do something more prohibitive? Because it doesn't say specifically that.
Right.
The second principle that we seem to have here is, can the state do this at all? Can the state say to cities, you have no right under home rule to change or alter what we have done on a statewide basis? Those seem to be two separate issues, are they not?
I agree, Your Honor. And I think that whether 1.63 is upheld or not, I think there's still a conflict here, because certainly 1.63, uncodified Section 3 of the bill, indicate that the General Assembly didn't want anyone regulating below the thresholds it had set. And that's independent of the, if you will, preemptive force or prohibitory force of 1.63. In addition, there's the question of, can the General Assembly, as part of a uniform statewide enactment in addressing a matter of statewide concern, adopt a prohibition such as 1.63? And with respect to that separate question, cases such as Cleveland Electric Illuminating, Kettering, decertification of Eastlake are all directly on point and suggest that in those cases, when we're dealing with a matter of genuine statewide concern, we're no longer implicating the local power of the municipality, because whatever regulation it adopts is going to have extraterritorial effect. That is, given the realities of this market, the mortgage market, if Cleveland adopts an ordinance, it's going to have an extraterritorial impact. It's going to end up affecting the mortgage rates for people in Akron, for people in Columbus, for people in Cincinnati.
I've interrupted you because your red light's on. We've never adopted that as a test, but that does seem to be, looking at our cases, there does seem to be some distinction between those cases in which the ordinance is very local, such as a billing standards, which different legal premise, but. The Cincinnati case is the number of rounds of an automatic weapon, the definition. Your argument is that, and Mr. Kulwitz's argument is that mortgage lending is not local, that in today's world it's very much a universal sort of activity in the second market, and that perhaps we've never stated a different test based on that premise, but I'm wondering whether we should be considering that. You were on the verge of saying that, and I cut you off, but that's an interesting issue to me, because I don't think we've ever made that distinction, but maybe we should.
Well, Your Honor, I definitely think the court should, and I think the court has. When we look back at a case like Cleveland Electric Illuminating, where the question was transmission of electrical power throughout the state, and could the General Assembly tell localities, hey, you can't interfere with our state regulations about the way transmission lines are going to work. And what the court said is, look, in today's market, the transmission of electricity throughout the state has become a matter of statewide concern. Allowing local ordinances that impede the General Assembly's plan for that would interfere with the electrical transmission and would hurt the state. And the proper locus, then, for regulatory authority was at the state level. That is, the Home Rule Amendment is concerned with deciding what's the proper locus for regulatory authority. Is it properly municipal, or is it properly state? And with respect to those things that are uniquely matters of statewide concern, I'm not suggesting this is a broad rule.
Counsel, I'm having a hard time understanding the comparison, though, between mortgage lending and the ability to wield power all over, not just the state, but we presumably wheel power in an interstate fashion as well, over
Absolutely
lines that
are.
Would run through municipalities. The connection on mortgage lending, what is unique about that means that mortgages made in Cleveland, Ohio, or Columbus, Ohio, are somehow interconnected with real estate mortgages made elsewhere?
Well, what's become unique about that market is the way in which local loans are packaged, bundled, securitized, and sold on a secondary market. And efficient transactions in that secondary market rely on uniform rules about the constituent parts of that bundle, such that if the person operating in the secondary market feels the need to go and say, geez, you've got 1,000 loans in this package, tell me which city they're in. Okay, now I've got to go look at the ordinances of all those different cities. And this could vary zip code by zip code. The market, the secondary purchaser just says, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in buying these loans.
So the secondary purchaser just says, well, this is a package, and we don't care whether these are loans in inner cities. We don't care how honest the appraisers were that appraised the underlying real estate. None of that matters to us. It just matters whether or not you complied with the state regulations. I can't believe that that, in the real world economic sense, is what drives the selling price.
I certainly don't want to suggest that there's no due diligence in connection with purchases in the secondary market,
Hope
Your Honor,
not.
But to add an overlay of regulatory due diligence.
If it would seem to me you would necessarily be interested in where are these properties? In what part of a community? Are they in a part of the community that is in steep decline? Are they in a part of a community that is doing very well? What's the track record of this institution's appraisers? Those seem to me to be far more important matters. And in doing that due diligence, you're going to have to do it neighborhood by neighborhood and city by city, aren't you?
Well, Your Honor, the only response I can make to that, obviously this is a factual question about how that market really works, and I think the best evidence we have in the record is to look back to what the economic expert testified to in the trial court, and he outlined the ways in which local regulation of these types of commodities will end up resulting in greater costs for all in Ohio who borrow mortgage money. The fact...
I guess I'm thinking that probably the major factor, just in an overview, would be what's been the track record of this institution that's trying to unload this paper on us. Have they been good? Do they do due diligence when they make their loans, or are they fast and loose? It seemed to me that. That would be, but it's still got to be individualized.
Your Honor, obviously there's some individualized component at looking at various loans, probably done by the packager of the loans on the front end rather than by anyone in the secondary market. But, you know, the best evidence we have, again, is I think what the economic expert testified to in the trial court, and he outlined several specific ways in which this type of regulation would end up raising mortgage costs for everyone. There is going to be an extraterritorial impact if Cleveland is allowed, if Akron is allowed, if Dayton is allowed, if Cincinnati is allowed. It's not just one city. If it's one, it's all. Well, if they're allowed to adopt these types of ordinances, it's going to raise lending costs. It's going to potentially result in lenders leaving the market, competition decreasing, which will, again, increase costs. I mean, the General Assembly, it seems to me, was within its legislative province in saying, we've looked at this, we've balanced these concerns, and we come out with needing uniform statewide regulation. And the question here then is, have we made enough of a case to show that the General Assembly was at least acting reasonably in deciding that this is one of those genuine matters of statewide concern where uniform statewide regulation is absolutely necessary?
Can you conceive of any home rule, additional regulation or further regulation that could be enacted that would not conflict with this general law you're talking about?
Your Honor, I think given the pervasiveness of the regulation here, plus the express intent that there not be, in a sense, any additional regulation, it would be hard. I think what would maybe come closest is to look back at the Fondacy case, where the local ordinance imposed merely a reporting requirement. And so potentially, if a city said, we'd like a report every month of how many predatory loans, or loans that the state defines as predatory, how many predatory loans you've entered, and, you know, please provide that type of information. That might survive under some kind of Fondacy analysis. Although I'll note, Fondacy was different in the sense that there the local ordinance evolved out of or was related to, in a sense, a land use notion, environmental waste dump. And land use is something where there's a rich tradition of local control. When we look at regulation of mortgage lending, by contrast, there is no rich tradition of local control. So in a sense, I think in a Fondacy type of case, we come at it with the presumption that there is some place at the table for locality, and then we look and maybe say, you know, adding some informational requirements, that's fine. Here, there isn't that backdrop that suggests that there has to be a strong role for municipality here. And then we look at, you know, the need for uniform statewide control and what the General Assembly has intended. And I think when we look at that, 1.63 is valid legislation with respect to preventing the municipalities from regulating. And even if it's not, I think the municipal ordinance here conflicts with the remainder, the substantive portions of House Bill 386 and its regulation of mortgage lending. So we ask the court to reverse the decision below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cole. Mr. Kaiser.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court. The most striking part of Mr. Kulowitz's argument was with reference to the Middleburg Heights case, when he said that the General Assembly had invited local government to step in and supplement the basic building code where there is no conflict. Well, up in Cleveland, we appreciate the General Assembly's largesse, but we don't need that invitation. Our invitation comes directly from the Ohio Constitution, Article 18, Section 3. We are permitted to enact and enforce any police power so long as it does not conflict with the general laws of this state. Once upon a time, lawmaking in Ohio was as these lenders wish it to be. State government held all the cards while municipalities were legislatively anemic. Charter municipalities, such as Cleveland, had no inherent authority under our Constitution to enact laws. But that all changed at the Constitutional Convention of 1912. The great debate in that convention was whether legislative power should remain centralized or become shared with local government, and local government won that fight. The convention adopted Article 18, Section 3, which says municipalities shall have authority to exercise all powers of local self-government and to adopt and enforce within their limits such local police, sanitary, and similar regulations as are not in conflict with general laws.
So your first line of defense is that they can't regulate this at all because you have the home rule right to regulate this.
That's not quite what I'm saying. If the state of Ohio wanted to get the city of Cleveland out of the anti-predatory lending business, it could easily do so. All it would have to do is permit or license predatory lending. It hasn't done it. It has remained silent with respect to those loans that are governed by the Cleveland ordinance.
Permit or license predatory lending? You mean to allow it?
To allow it. Instead remained silent.
Is that your second argument, that because they haven't prohibited X, Y, and Z, you can prohibit it and it's not in conflict? I mean, am I right that you have two arguments? One is that your home rule allows you to regulate, period, no matter what the state does. And then your second argument is that the state has regulated at X level, we can regulate at Y level. Are those two distinct arguments, or am I blurring it?
My argument is that the state of Ohio, with the statute under review, has neither permitted nor prohibited the loans of the sort that Cleveland has chosen to deal with. Since they haven't prohibited it, we're allowed to step in and prohibit it. Since they haven't permitted it, we can enact the ordinance that we did.
So your argument is similar to the Cincinnati gun case, that there's a level the state has not said you can't do below, and therefore you can do that.
The Cincinnati gun case, with all due respect, the way I think it should be decided, by the way, I think Cincinnati probably loses that case, but for a different reason. Under the infamous crime provision, Article 1, Section 10 of the Ohio Constitution, cities are not allowed to make an infamous crime a misdemeanor. The state of Ohio has made possession of a semi-automatic firearm with a magazine capacity in excess of 31 rounds a felony, an infamous crime by definition. Cincinnati, since it didn't have any cap, I'll step back. What Cincinnati did was they passed an ordinance that said any possession of 10 or more rounds, in the case of long rifles, 10 or more rounds is illegal, and it's a misdemeanor. What Cincinnati should have done and didn't.
So that really doesn't have anything to do with what we're here arguing about, does it?
Well, let him
I think it does.
Justice Stratton asked a question. But Justice Stratton asked the question. Let him answer the question.
And here's what it has to do with, Your Honor. If Cincinnati had said possession between 10 magazine capacity and 30 magazine capacity is illegal, I think that they'd have been okay. But they said 10 or more, which means in the city of Cincinnati, if you had a weapon with 35 rounds in it, it would be a misdemeanor, and you can't do that under the infamous crime provision of the Ohio Constitution, because the state has declared it to be a felony. That's the way I would see the Cincinnati gun case that was argued last month here.
Okay, so that's the distinction you're drawing between the threshold issue.
It is.
Okay.
Let me take you to this case. Go ahead.
I want to come back. But that's a different constitutional argument than is present in this case. The distinction you're drawing in the Cincinnati case has a whole different...
It does. But if this court should not decide the Cincinnati case the way I just suggested, if you get putting that problem aside, then I would decide the case in favor of Cincinnati.
I'm not suggesting there isn't overlap here, but the issue you were going off on there is not an issue of overlap, right?
I agree. But getting past that issue that I just addressed, then I would rule in favor of the city of Cincinnati because state government has not permitted carrying of a weapon with less than 31 rounds. They've remained silent on it. And there are two sources of lawmaking in Ohio. There's the state general assembly, and there are local municipalities. We have police power. Unless the state says expressly you have permission to carry a gun with fewer than 31 rounds, then cities are permitted to step in and prohibit it.
Well, can you help me with section 163 that says the state solely shall regulate the business of originating, granting, servicing, and collecting loans?
Your Honor.
What does solely mean?
It means only them, and they are not permitted to preempt our lawmaking ability. We've had this lawmaking ability since 1912, and the General Assembly cannot step in and take it away from us.
So going back to what Justice Stratton asked you, your position is the Home Rule Amendment, your first argument is that the Home Rule Amendment indicates you have the right to do this, and that this statute is unconstitutional on that provision. That's exactly right.
In fact, Your Honor, before you even arrive at a conflict analysis, first you have to determine whether the state statute that's allegedly in conflict is a general law or not. And we know from this court's most recent decision in the city of Canton case that laws of this nature are not general laws because they do not regulate conduct of individuals.
So this really your argument is 163 is not a general law, and if it is, we have the right under the Constitution to also regulate this field.
That's right.
I'd need to have some clarification. I thought from your brief that we pretty much agreed that this was a general law. You don't agree with that?
1.63 is not a general law.
Not 1.63, 386, the substantive law. We're talking about the substantive law here.
Oh, the rest of the House bill?
Right.
Yes. It's
okay. Yeah,
police power.
Sure. You were on the verge, I thought, of talking about conflict by implication. And I'd like to hear your strongest argument as to why we should not adopt conflict by implication here.
Your Honor, the other side of this case refers to the Struthers versus Sokol case for support of what they believe is conflict by implication. The fact of the matter is, the Sokol case doesn't even use the phrase conflict by implication. It doesn't stand for that. The syllabus of Sokol stands for just the opposite. It says, in determining whether an ordinance is in conflict with general laws, the test is whether the ordinance permits or licenses that which the statute forbids and prohibits, and vice versa. The test is one of conflict. Conflict by implication has no place in our home rule jurisprudence. It simply has not been recognized by this court. It certainly wasn't recognized in Sokol.
Well, let's explore it, though, that the concept is that if the General Assembly has said this is the limit of conduct, that by implication the General Assembly is saying that any conduct up to that is okay, is acceptable, and that when a city attempts to define conduct more strictly than how the General Assembly has defined it, that that's by implication, well, there's a conflict because the General Assembly, when it sets a standard, is saying that any conduct up to that is acceptable. What's your argument against the concept?
Your Honor, the General Assembly is fully aware of what happened in 1912, that there are two sources of authority in this state for the making of police powers. We don't need to apply anything. If the General Assembly wants to, it can say, and all other predatory loans are legal.
Well, but that gets us to 1.63, doesn't it?
Pardon?
That gets us to 1.63. That's what they've said.
It doesn't because, no. Well, they haven't.
By implication.
They tried to preempt, but they're not allowed to preempt. The test under...
Well, but you just said if they want to preempt, that's the way they do it. And so that's what they've done here. I may agree with you that 1.63 cannot trump the Constitution, the authority of cities to have home rule power, which 1.63 here seems to attempt to do. But I thought you just sort of used that as your reason, as your example of how the General Assembly could preempt the field.
Perhaps I'm not being as clear on this as I should be. Cities are not allowed to prohibit that which the state has permitted. If the state permitted stripping, flipping, packing, those things that are addressed in our ordinance, then we couldn't prohibit it and our ordinance would fall. But the state of Ohio can't declare an intention to occupy the field and then not occupy. They're not allowed to preempt, and that's why 1.63 is unconstitutional. But
when they, again, I guess that we don't want to argue with you, but when the General Assembly says this conduct is prohibited, aren't they saying that all other conduct that is not as egregious as that conduct, for lack of a better word, is permitted?
They're not, Your Honor. That's not the way
they
I see it.
I have to say, how do they write legislation then to indicate that that all other conduct is acceptable? They say that expressly?
They could say stripping, flipping, and packing are legal within this state. And if they did that, if they permitted it, if they licensed it, the city of Cleveland would not be allowed to prohibit it. We can't prohibit what the state permits or licenses.
Yeah, but we're not talking about stripping, flipping, and the Cleveland ordinance is very specific, detailed sort of requirements that are not in the state statute that may or may not conflict with the state statute.
Well, the Cleveland ordinance steps in between 4.5 and 8 points,
right,
plus the yield on certain treasury securities, coupled with other prohibited things like stripping, packing, flipping, negative amortization. If you have a loan of a certain interest rate coupled with one of these other forbidden things, then it's illegal under our predatory lending ordinance.
Now, if the state stepped in and prohibited flipping, stripping, all those things you've mentioned, what would Cleveland be allowed to do?
We couldn't permit it.
Could you be more restrictive than what the state prohibited on those three things?
Within the classification of penalty, we could. If Cleveland wanted to, we could enact an ordinance that is a carbon copy of the state statute. But since the state statute makes it a felony, it's a fifth-degree felony, we wouldn't be allowed to make it a misdemeanor. That's under the Cleveland versus Betts
Council
case.
Could you address the economic argument that has been advanced that this is somehow comparable with wheeling power or the commerce of driving through communities in terms of its effect the ordinance's effect on all the rest of the citizens of the state?
Your Honor, the economic argument that Mr. Cole presented certainly is not supported by this record. I'd like to call the court's attention to the Dunkelberg testimony, not his affidavit. If you read his affidavit, you'll think the sky is falling. But when I got a chance to cross-examine him, here's what the man said. He could not quantify the increase in borrowing costs, did not know if any lenders actually pulled out of the market as a result of the ordinance, did not consider himself an expert on the effects of predatory lending in Cleveland, was unable to predict what most banks will do in light of the city's ordinances, and astonishingly, doesn't know if the ordinance will cause irreparable harm. That's all in the city supplement from about page 30 to page 35. When the expert on the other side of the case admits that he doesn't know if the ordinance will cause irreparable harm, that's pretty damning stuff where the plaintiff seeks preliminary injunction. It's astonishing. The economic harm argument doesn't make it. It's not to be found on this record. It's simply not there. Your Honor, I see that my time has expired. I would ask that this court affirm the 8th District. We believe they got it right. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kaiser. Mr. Kulowitz, Mr. Cole, we've taken you well beyond your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. Two very brief points. This court, at page 268 of the Struthers versus Sokol case, explicitly stated that a state and local law conflict if the state law either expressly or inferentially from its conduct that the municipal ordinance prohibits. So that test has been there from the outset of home rule jurisprudence. And secondly, the city conspicuously has made no effort to defend the conflict test on which the Cuyahoga County Court of Appeals relied, because that test is borrowed from the Cincinnati Bell versus Cincinnati case, which arose under completely different sections of the Ohio Constitution and involved completely different concepts as to the ability of the state to preempt municipal taxation. This court explained in there why that is conceptually different from this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kulowitz. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.